All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 631 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, we're going to be addressing a topic I title Travel Medicine. This is going to be a two-part series because it's just going to be too much to load into one podcast. Okay, it's going to be a 2 to 3 part series, but I'm going to try to keep it to two parts. And the thing about travel medicine is, number one, it tends to contain a bunch of obscure things. Number two, these obscure things tend to show up a lot on the USMLE exams. Number three, if you just know a few key things, you're going to be pretty good to go with these topics. And then number four, the USMLEs, they really do want you to emphasize mechanisms in your understanding of these topics. Okay, so we're going to try to address this in a format that's going to be very helpful to you for your USMLE exams. All right, so first things first, what if they give you a question about a patient that is about to travel to some place and requires pre-travel vaccines? How long before traveling should you give those people those necessary vaccines? Well, I would hope you're picking the answer choice that talks about 2 to 4 weeks, right? 2 to 4 weeks. The thing is, you want to give these vaccines 2 to 4 weeks before the person travels. Why? Because you want them to mount an adequate antibody response. You want them to mount an adequate antibody response. And the thing is, sometimes you may even have to stretch out that timing to longer than 4 weeks if it's a vaccine that requires multiple doses. That's something you definitely want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And again, in thinking of this topic, just think of the population you're giving the vaccine to, right? So just be mindful of that, right? So like, for example, if a person is immunocompromised, let's say their CD4 count is less than 200, or the person is pregnant, right? Or the person has some kind of immunodeficiency disease, you would know to not give them a live attenuated vaccine, right? So something like the yellow fever vaccine, that would not be smart. Or a person like the oral typhoid vaccine, that's live attenuated, right? That's live attenuated, right? Or the MMR vaccine, right? Things like that. Don't give it to those people, those special populations, people under age 1, people that are pregnant, people that have CD4s under 200, right? Or people that have immunodeficiency diseases. No, it's not going to be a smart idea for those people, right? But then, many of the other, vaccines, right? Like the inactivated vaccines, things like Hep A, Hep B, right? Typhoid, the injectable one, right? So don't mess this up on your exams, right? The oral typhoid has two kinds of vaccines. There's the oral one and there's the injectable one. The oral one is live attenuated. The injectable one is an inactivated vaccine, right? Is an inactivated vaccine. So if a person is immunocompromised, don't give them the oral typhoid, give them the injectable typhoid vaccine. Again, it's little details like this that kind of mess people up on their exams, right? So just something to keep in mind for your test. All right. So I think the first bug we should talk about, probably the one that is tested the most frequently, is malaria, right? So let's talk about malaria, right? So we know that malaria, again, having mosquito netting is very, very helpful in prevention, right? Having mosquito netting is very, very helpful in prevention, right? That's a very simple thing to do. Very, very helpful in prevention, right? Very, very helpful in prevention, right? In fact, that's going to be a method of primary prevention, right? You basically like have the net, right? Like a pesticide treated net, and then that reduces your risk of being bitten by the Anopheles mosquito, right? Remember, malaria is caused by the Plasmodium species, and those Plasmodium species are carried by the Anopheles mosquito, right? By the Anopheles mosquito, right? So one classic thing they love to do on the USMLE exams is that they love to test the drugs used for malaria prophylaxis. And sometimes they love to test the mechanisms of action of those drugs. And they're not just only the mechanisms of action of those drugs, but the contraindications to those drugs. You absolutely need to know this for your exams. So the drugs used for malaria prophylaxis, the contraindications to those drugs, and some basic mechanism of action detail on those drugs, right? So like, for example, the first one is going to be atovaquone proguanil. That is like a very classic one they test on the exams. Atovaquone proguanil, right? Basically, this one, it does two things, right? It inhibits the electron transport chain and it shuts down folate synthesis, right? And the reason that this is probably like the most common one tested on the USMLE exams is that there is very little resistance to it. But if you have bad kidneys, you have no business being on atovaquone proguanil, okay? If you have bad kidneys, you better not be on it. Another classic one you may see on your exams is mefloquine. Mefloquine, don't worry about the mechanism of action for your test. But this one, they love it. Just think of mefloquine as the contraindicated in the crazy, okay? Think of it as being contraindicated in the crazy. What do I mean by that? If you have a history of like a seizure disorder, right? Or a psychiatric condition, right? Do not take mefloquine, right? And also, if you have like cardiac conduction problems, right? Like you have like AV nodal disease, for example, mefloquine is not a good idea at all. Now, are there some other drugs on the USMLE exams that are not necessarily for malaria, but are kind of like neurotoxic, to where it's like, maybe you want to be careful about giving this to people that have a history of like whatevers. You want to think about interferon alpha. Interferon alpha is a big one. Remember, we use that to treat hep C. If you have a history of like major depressive disorder or suicidal ideation, interferon alpha is maybe not the best idea, right? It's maybe not the best idea in those circumstances. All right, let's keep going, right? And then doxycycline. Right, doxycycline, remember, this is a 30S inhibitor, right? It's a 30S inhibitor. That's something you absolutely need to know for your exams, right? So it's a protein synthesis inhibitor, right? Remember, doxycycline is okay in kids. You can give it to kids even under age 8, right? But again, the USMLEs, they are still leery of you giving doxycycline to people that are pregnant, right? The USMLEs, they don't really like doxycycline in the pregnant, right? Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind on your exams. And there's not much resistance to doxycycline. Doxycycline is pretty effective. Now, one thing you want to know about doxycycline is they can give you a question about a person that took doxycycline for malaria prophylaxis, right? And then they travel to a tropical area. And then they tell you that they've been having this skin rash that seems to worsen whenever they go on the beach. Whenever you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about the photosensitivity that goes with tetracyclines, okay? It is very high yield for purposes of your exams to know the drugs that cause photosensitivity. There's a very nice mnemonic you've probably heard from back in the day called SAT for photo. SAT for photo, the S stands for sulfonamides, the A stands for amiodarone, and the T stands for tetracyclines, right? Those drugs are associated with photosensitivity, right? And then there's some other disorders you may see on your exams that are associated with photosensitivity, right? So things like Chiriaki Gashi, right? Photosensitivity, things like lupus, also associated with photosensitivity, right? So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your test. All right. And then let's go back to the malaria drugs, right? And then chloroquine, right? Chloroquine, the key thing to know here is there's a lot of resistance, and it pretty much inhibits heme synthesis, right? In Plasmodium species, right? But again, there is like widespread resistance. However, one high yield thing you want to know for purposes of your exams is that chloroquine can cause arthropathy, right? When you use chloroquine chronically, it can cause arthropathy. Is there another drug that kind of sounds like chloroquine that can also cause arthropathy? I hope you're saying yes. That's going to be hydroxychloroquine, right? The thing that everybody thought could magically cure COVID, right? Even if it doesn't really do that, or it does it to a limited extent. But hydroxychloroquine also causes arthropathy, right? Remember, hydroxychloroquine is one of these drugs that you can actually use to treat like rheumatoid arthritis in people that are pregnant, right? Because remember, if you have RA and you're pregnant, maybe it's not a good idea to take methotrexate. You know, you probably don't want to kill the baby, right? So, I mean, that circumstance, you want to consider using hydroxychloroquine. It is safe in pregnancy. But remember, hydroxychloroquine can absolutely cause arthropathy, okay? Hydroxychloroquine can absolutely cause arthropathy. You need to know that for your exams. And one other thing I'm going to say about malaria before I kind of wrap this up with malaria is, don't forget, many of these malaria drugs, especially primaquine. Remember, primaquine is a drug we can use for malaria, right? But another use is, you know, to kill the dormant forms that can stay in the liver, like Plasmodium vivax and ovale, right? Those hypnozoid forms, they can stay dormant in the liver. Primaquine is pretty good for those, right? But remember, primaquine is a very powerful oxidizing agent, right? So the thing is, because it's a very powerful oxidizing agent, it's not a great idea in people that have G6PD deficiency, right? So they can give you a question about a person that's about to initiate primaquine therapy. And then they can ask you like, oh, what is the most appropriate next best step in management? You want to pick the answer that involves screening them for G6PD, checking their G6PD levels, right? Or they can give you a question about a person that is given primaquine. And, you know, a few days after they get the primaquine, you notice that they have an increase in their indirect bilirubin, right? And you notice that they have like jaundice. And then they can ask you about the mechanism behind their symptoms, right? You can talk about impaired regeneration of glutathione, okay? Pick the answer choice that talks about the impaired regeneration of glutathione. Let me tell you something here, right? I know some of you may be like, Divine, why are you talking about impaired regeneration of glutathione? Couldn't they make it simpler like G6PD deficiency or impaired NADPH production? To be honest with you, if that's what they did on the exams, everybody will get a 270 on their exams. Clearly, That does not happen. You know why that does not happen? Because that's not how they test information, right? On the USMLE exams, they test information with the prerogative to see if you can think beyond just the surface level, right? If you can think beyond just the surface level, right? Because remember, the reason why G6PD deficiency is such a problem, and by the way, remember, it's X-linked recessive, right? So it's going to be like a man problem on your exams, right? But the primary problem is that if you have a deficiency of glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, you're not going to be able to make NADPH. And NADPH is necessary for glutathione regeneration because remember, glutathione is the thing that helps us deal with oxidative stress, right? Helps us deal with oxidative stress. Something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. All right. Now, let's jump on. So we've talked about malaria. I'm trying to, again, hit the high yield things. Let's talk about traveler's diarrhea, right? Traveler's diarrhea is another very common thing you may see on your test, right? Now, one classic thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is this. What is the most common cause of traveler's diarrhea? What is the most common cause of traveler's diarrhea? It's going to be ETEC, right? Enterotoxigenic E. coli. Enterotoxigenic E. coli, right? And the thing is, typically, it's going to cause a watery diarrhea, right? But the thing is, there is one point of contention our friends at the MBMEs like to bring to basically kind of throw you for a loop on your test. So basically kind of throw you for a loop on your test. And that's something I think I want you to keep in mind for your exams, right? What is that thing? The thing is, Giardia can also cause traveler's diarrhea, right? Giardia can also cause traveler's diarrhea. And sometimes the presentation can be almost identical to ETEC. So one classic thing people ask me is, Divine, how can I differentiate Giardia as the cause of traveler's diarrhea from ETEC as the cause of traveler's diarrhea? Look at your timeline. If the person has traveler's diarrhea that is lasting for just a few days, think about ETEC. Think about enterotoxigenic E. coli. But if the person has traveler's diarrhea that seems to last for weeks, and then you see antecedents of like steatorrhea, like fat malabsorption, like fat in their stool, you want to think more along the lines of Giardia. You want to think more along the lines of Giardia. And you may wonder, like, Divine, what is the mechanism? Why does this happen? Well, the thing is, Giardia literally damages your intestinal mucosa. It literally damages your microvilli. If you damage the microvilli, do you think you're going to be able to reabsorb things very well? Not really. You're not going to be able to reabsorb things very well at all. So if that happens, you're going to have malabsorption, right? And steatorrhea is a very good finding in malabsorption. And then you're like, Divine, why does it last so long? Well, the thing is, it kind of takes the body a little bit of time to clear Giardia. And also, after Giardia has destroyed your microvilli, it takes a while for those microvilli to get regenerated, right? So that's why their symptoms tend to be a little more long-lasting. Again, if you understand the pathophase like this, then you're not just like mindlessly memorizing details. All right, now let's delve a little deeper on ETEC, right? Because again, classic thing they love to test on the exams is, hey, how does ETEC cause problems for you? ETEC does not necessarily damage your microvilli, so it doesn't cause malabsorptive problems. What it does is that it has two toxins, right? It has a heat labile toxin and a heat stable toxin, right? And the heat labile toxin, what does it do? The heat labile toxin activates adenylate cyclase. When you activate adenylate cyclase, right, you're going to convert ATP to cyclic AMP, right? You're going to stimulate protein kinase A. And that's going to cause you to dump a lot of chloride ions into the lumen of your GI tract. As you dump all those chloride ions into the lumen of your GI tract, is going to attract water, and then that's going to cause you to have diarrhea, right? The heat-stable toxin is going to activate guanylate cyclase, right? It's going to activate what? Guanylate cyclase, right? Guanylate cyclase. When you activate guanylate cyclase, you're going to convert GTP to cyclic GMP, and then cyclic GMP is going to activate protein kinase G. And when you activate protein kinase G, you're going to make you're going to also, again, secrete a lot of chloride into the lumen of the GI tract. So water is going to follow, and you're going to have diarrhea. But let me ask you this. What kind of diarrhea is this? What kind of diarrhea will that be? It's going to be a secretory diarrhea because that's the mechanism behind the diarrhea, right? A lot of chloride ions are being secreted into the lumen of the GI tract, and then water is following, and then you are having diarrhea. So it's going to be a secretory diarrhea. Contrast this with a person having giardial diarrhea that tends to be more of a malabsorptive diarrhea, okay? So again, on your exams, they can literally give you an ETEC question. And instead of putting ETEC as the answer, they'll just put secretory diarrhea as the answer. Or on your exams, they can give you a giardial question. And instead of putting giardia as an answer, they will just put malabsorptive diarrhea as the answer. Again, please be aware of surrogates. Basically, I like to think of the USMLEs as follows. I like to think of it as an exam where they want you to know a given concept in six different languages, right? Because they can present any of those six different languages. But the thing is, you may ask yourself, Divine, how am I able to pick up on these six different languages? Honestly, the best way is to just understand pathophysiology. The thing is, when you understand pathophysiology, it's almost like you understand how those six different languages were created, right? So if they give you an example that is novel or unusual, many times it's still going to reflect that underlying pathophysiology that you should have understood in the first place. Okay, so again, remember, ETEC mostly causes a secretory diarrhea. It's going to be a watery diarrhea. They're going to have a lot of cramping, right? And typically when you check those people's stools, you're not going to see white blood cells. You're not going to see blood in their stools. And how do we treat ETEC? Well, you can treat ETEC with a fluoroquinolone, or you can use azithromycin plus loperamide, right? A fluoroquinolone or azithromycin plus loperamide, right? Remember, loperamide is a weak mu opioid receptor agonist, right? So that can help the diarrhea by basically causing a milder constipation, right? And then remember, Giardia, again, long-lasting diarrhea is going to be greasy, right? Signs of fat malabsorption, they're going to have bloating, they're going to have foul-smelling stools, and we're going to manage that with metronidazole or T-nidazole, right? And then if you see a person that has bloody diarrhea and it's traveler's diarrhea, I really want you to think of Campylobacter or think of Shigella. Think of Campylobacter or think of Shigella. Believe it or not, even if many times these are tested in terms of mainstream gastroenteritis, they can also be tested on the USMLE exams in the context of bloody diarrhea, traveler's diarrhea. Okay, so keep that at the back of your mind for exams, right? So like, for example, Campylobacter, if they give you a question about a person that has bloody diarrhea, and then they tell you that the person has like lower extremity weakness, then I want you to think of that person having Campylobacter jejuni infection, right? Because that lower extremity weakness tells you that, this person has Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Guillain-Barré syndrome. And again, we're going to manage it with azithromycin, or you can use a fluoroquinolone, right? Again, if you're, one annoying thing our friends at the MBMEs can do is they can give you both as answers. They can give you azithromycin as an answer. They can give you a fluoroquinolone as an answer. If they give you both as answers, which one should you pick? The USMLEs totally do this to people all the time. They'll give you two right answers that work for the question, but one is a better answer than the other. If you see those, pick azithromycin. Pick the macrolide answer. Why? Well, the thing is, there is less resistance to macrolides compared to fluoroquinolones. That's number one. Number two, fluoroquinolones have a lot of toxicities, right? They can do things like explode your Achilles. They can cause an Achilles tendinopathy, and they can also prolong the QT interval. The only problem you're worried about with azithromycin is that, hey, this could prolong my QT interval, but at least it does not explode your Achilles and there's not as much resistance as we have with fluoroquinolones. All right. And then Shigella, right? Shigella, again, bloody diarrhea, very high fevers, right? They may have signs and symptoms of the hemolytic uremic syndrome. So if you see a person having bloody diarrhea and they have like big time thrombocytopenia, right? They have big time thrombocytopenia, right? They have like elevated creatinine. They probably want to think more about Shigella as the cause of their traveler's diarrhea as against Campylobacter jejuni. And again, you can treat this with a fluoroquinolone or azithromycin, right? So hopefully like you're beginning to see kind of a trend here. Many of these traveler's diarrhea causes can be controlled very well with azithromycin or a fluoroquinolone, right? Azithromycin or a fluoroquinolone, right? The one big exception we've talked about today is Giardia, right? That we use metronidazole or tinidazole for, right? Make sure you know the bugs that are covered by metronidazole, right? There's this nice mnemonic you've probably heard, get gap on the metro, right? So like Giardia, Entamoeba histolytica, that's the E, right? So get gap on the metro, right? So G for Giardia, E for Entamoeba histolytica, the thing that causes amoebiasis, T for trichomoniasis, right? And then the other G for Gardnerella vaginalis, the A for anaerobes, and then the P for protozoans, right? Those are the drugs that, those are the bugs that are covered by a metronidazole. All right. And then the last thing I want to talk about with traveler's diarrhea, this is actually something they love to test. And this is something that gets a lot of people because people don't think about this as a potential cause of traveler's diarrhea. But think of Cryptosporidium parvum. Think of Cryptosporidium parvum. Think of Cryptosporidium parvum. Cryptosporidium parvum, and you're going to see after the discussion I have on Cryptosporidium parvum, why they really love to test it a lot on the USMLEs. The reason they love to test it a lot on the USMLEs is that there are so many integrations you can make with Cryptosporidium parvum for your exams, right? So many of us know the classic, you see watery diarrhea in a HIV patient, Cryptosporidium parvum, right? And many times they will talk about the acid fast osis in the stool. Remember, Cryptosporidium is acid fast, is acid fast. So if they tell you about a person that is immunocompromised and the person has acid fast osis in their stool, think of Cryptosporidium Parvum. Okay, think of Cryptosporidium Parvum. And remember that Cryptosporidium Parvum is treated with nitazoxanide, right? It's treated with the drug nitazoxanide. Now, the thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they know that everybody that has the job description, medical student or USMLE exam taker has memorized Cryptosporidium causes diarrhea in HIV patients, right? So what do? These days, they like to test it as a cause of traveler's diarrhea. Okay, but it's going to typically present as traveler's diarrhea in an immunocompromised person, or it can prevent as traveler's diarrhea in an immunocompetent person, and then they will give you the stool results. They'll say that, oh wow, this person is immunocompetent, you know, the person doesn't have like any HIV or immunodeficiency disease, but you know, the person has diarrhea, you know, profuse watery diarrhea, and then they tell you that, oh, they do some testing of the stool and they find acid fast ulcers. When you see that, then you want to think about Cryptosporidium Parvum, right? So if you see a traveler's diarrhea context in a person that is immunocompetent and you see acid fast ulcers in the stool, the person has Cryptosporidium Parvum infection, right? And again, remember, Cryptosporidium Parvum, right? It's an intracellular protozoan, right? It likes to infect your small intestinal epithelium, right? That's why it causes nasty diarrhea. Okay, and the thing is, believe it or not, people can also get Cryptosporidium Parvum from swimming in pools that are chlorine treated, right? Because the thing is, chlorine does nothing to Cryptosporidium Parvum. That's actually something that is pretty high yield to know for your exams. A chlorine treated pool does not mean that Cryptosporidium Parvum has been killed, right? So again, like I said, it can present in immunocompetent people, or it can present immunocompromised people, right? In fact, the thing is, most times when people are immunocompetent, you don't have to treat them. They don't need nitazoxanide, right? So think of nitazoxanide as something you do for a person that has C. parvum infection that is immunocompromised, okay? So the thing is, if a person is immunocompetent and they have cryptosporidial diarrhea, it's self-limited, you know, within a week or two, they're going to get better, right? And why do they get better? Well, because they have functioning immune systems. Let me tell you this. Your CD4 positive T cells are extremely critical for dealing with Cryptosporidium Parvum. I'm going to say that again. Your CD4 positive T cells are extremely critical for dealing with Cryptosporidium Parvum infections, right? So if you're a person that is immunocompetent, you have well-functioning CD4 positive T cells. You're going to clear that infection. But if you're a person that has HIV, right? Your CD4 positive T cells have been nuked and destroyed. Then in that circumstance, you're probably going to struggle with this infection, right? So if you see a person that has like cholera-like diarrhea and they're immunocompromised, like a HIV patient, think of Cryptosporidium Parvum infection. Many times, it's going to show up as a nasty infection in a person that has a very, very low CD4 count. Typically, it's going to be a person that has a CD4 count that is under 200, right? So you're going to see it present as like just severe, chronic, nasty diarrhea. They can be pooping more than 10 liters of fluid a day, right? Severe, nasty, chronic diarrhea, right? And they will have like nasty malabsorption, a lot of weight loss. They'll be like super dehydrated, right? And the thing is, one strange association they love, our friends at the MBMEs love to test with Cryptosporidium Parvum, is that it can spread to your biliary tract. It can cause ascending cholangitis. It can cause acute pancreatitis. It can literally spread to your biliary tract. It can literally spread to your biliary tract, right? So the thing you may be asking is, Divine, why do they love to test it in people that have CD4s under 200 typically? Again, it can happen in people with CD4s over 200, but classically, when they are testing a HIV patient that has Cryptosporidium Parvum infection, their CD4 count is usually going to be less than 200. Well, why is that? Because again, the people that are more likely to get this are people that have severely clobbered CD4 positive T cell counts, right? And hey, if your CD4 positive T cell count is under 200, you're going to have a severely clobbered count, right? That's going to make it very, very difficult for you to be able to clear the infection, right? In fact, let me tell you this. Okay. Whenever you see me laugh like this, it's because it's like, oh, yep, this is another thing they do on the USMLE exams to people. See, on the exams, they can give you a question about a person that has poorly controlled HIV, right? They'll tell you the person has not seen their physician in many years. And then they describe this person's CD4 count as being like 60. And then they tell you that the person has had like profuse, watery, foul-smelling diarrhea for the last few weeks, right? And then they say that, oh, a stool study is positive for acid fast ulcers. And then they ask, which of the following would most likely lead to long-term resolution of this patient's symptoms or most likely improve the patient's prognosis? Pick the answer that talks about initiation of antiretroviral therapy. I'm going to say that again. Pick the answer that talks about the initiation of antiretroviral therapy. The thing is, if you put a person that has cryptosporidium problem infection, if you put them on nitazoxanide, right, an immunocompromised person, it will help their symptoms, but they will not completely clear the infection. That infection will stay persistent in those people for a very, very long period of time. If you want to truly clear cryptosporidium problem infection, you need your CD4 positive T cells to come back online. You literally need your CD4 positive T cells to come back online. Okay? So nitazoxanide, again, it can help. It can help, but it will not completely clear the infection, right? In fact, again, they can make this a prognosis question. Again, I was discussing this in one of the classes I thought last week. You know, I was telling people that, hey, they love to test prognosis a lot on the USMLE exams these days, right? And what is one classic way they love to test prognosis? They love to test it in a context like this, for example, right? In a context like this, right? You truly will improve a person's prognosis for cryptosporidium problem infection when you initiate antiretroviral therapy. In fact, that is the most important intervention in properly clearing cryptosporidium problem infection. You can give them nitazoxanide, but it's basically like a temporizing measure. You want to permanently clear that problem? Go ahead and boost their CD4 positive T cell count by giving them what? Antiretroviral therapy. Now, one other angle that they love to test with cryptosporidium parvum infection on the exams is that they also love to test it in the context of iris, right? So they'll give you a question about a person that had a CD4 count of like 40, and then the person was initiated and the person had like, you know, very nasty, you know, weeks of like watery diarrhea and all these things. And then they ask you, and the person has weeks of watery diarrhea, right? And then they tell you that, oh, pharmacotherapy is initiated. Or they can even make it a two-part question, right? You know, nitazoxanide therapy is initiated, and the patient is also placed on antiretroviral therapy, right? They can make that the first part of the question. They can test things around those concepts for the first part of the question. And then the second part, they can say that, you know, 1 week after therapy is initiated, the patient presents with, like, worsening diarrhea, you know, very high fevers, severely, you know, profound weight loss, and profound dehydration. And then they ask you, which of the following is the most appropriate next best step in management? I would really hope you're picking the answer choice that says to continue antiretroviral therapy, continue nitazoxanide, and if necessary, go ahead and give them steroids. So what's going on with this person? Well, this person has something called iris. This person has immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. Immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. Our friends at the MBMEs, they love to test iris a lot. And many times they love to test it in the context of cryptosporidium parvum infection. Okay? Basically, what is iris? Iris is basically like, so immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. Like literally look at the name. Immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. You're literally reconstituting the immune system, and then you get an inflammatory syndrome from that, right? So say, for example, how will this arise in a person that has cryptosporidium? If you understand this model, then whatever, you know, any other model is going to make sense to you, right? But basically, if a person has cryptosporidium parvum infection, they're immunocompromised, right? They're like a HIV patient, really bad HIV, right? When you start antiretroviral therapy, the CD4 positive T cell count is going to start rising. Right now, as that CD4 positive T cell count starts rising, your immune system begins to recover. So your immune system that is recovering is going to be like, I am going to search out every cryptosporidium that is in the body. I'm going to destroy them. I'm literally going to destroy them. So what does your immune system do? The thing your immune system does is that it starts going after tissues that contain cryptosporidium in them, right? It starts going after tissues that contain cryptosporidium in them, that have cryptosporidial antigens, right? And that initial inflammatory cascade, right? Because we find cryptosporidium parvum in the GI tract, right? That initial inflammatory cascade, guess what it does? It's going to just absolutely destroy many parts of your GI tract. So that can cause you to temporarily have a worsening diarrhea, right? So those people may have a temporary worsening of their diarrhea. They may have a temporary worsening of their abdominal complaints, but they will get better over time. Just tell them to stay the course, right? So how do you manage immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome? Literally, continue antiretroviral therapy. Literally, continue the nitazoxanide, right? Although if the person is immunocompetent, you really don't have to do that nitazoxanide, right? But for the immunocompromised person, nitazoxanide, right? Give them nitazoxanide, give them antiretroviral therapy, right? Because again, remember, upregulation of their T cell count is the most important intervention in controlling and in clearing cryptosporidium problem infection. But a third thing you should also do for those people is steroids, right? If it's really, really bad, then consider giving them steroids. Consider giving them steroids, okay? Consider giving them steroids, right? So again, these people, CD4 positive T cells, the T helper 1 cells, they come back online, right? And remember, your T helper 1 cells are involved with cell mediated immunity. So any cell that contains cryptosporidial antigens, they're going to start attacking them hard. They're going to literally start attacking them hard. Right? But again, typically those people are going to get better over time, right? It's basically a transient inflammatory flare. You know, I just like to think of it this way, right? Like say, for example, if you've not eaten for a long period of time, let's say you've been fasting for 7 days. The first time you see food, you're going to eat that food very aggressively. Second time you see food, you're going to eat that food very aggressively, very violently. But by the third plate of food, the fourth plate of food, you're going to kind of slow down a little bit because now you've had food, right? Things are not as bad, right? So the thing is, kind of like the same thing happens with immune reconstitution inflammatory syndrome. Your immune system is coming back online, right? So it wants to kind of flex its muscles. It wants to show that, hey, I'm back. But after it kind of flexes its muscles, kind of cleans things up, it then kind of goes back to its like normal baseline state, right? So again, it's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams, okay? All right. And again, remember, one other thing that may be used for traveler's diarrhea before I'm kind of done with traveler's diarrhea is don't forget, traveler's diarrhea, one other way some people treat it is with bismuth subsalicylate, right? Now, if a person has a history of like aspirin allergy, right? Or a person has a history of like aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, giving bismuth subsalicylate is maybe not a good idea. Like literally contains salicylic acid, right? So if you have like an aspirin allergy, and some people can have profound aspirin allergies, bismuth subsalicylate is not a good idea. Because again, remember, bismuth subsalicylate basically contains aspirin. It basically contains aspirin. All right. Now, next thing I want to talk about here, what if they give you a question about a patient? Right? What if they give you a question about a patient and this patient, you're told that, oh, this person, you know, traveled to some foreign country, right? And the person has like extremely high fevers, very severe headache, and that they have retroorbital pain. They have pain behind the eyes, right? They have a lot of myalgias, a lot of arthralgias, right? And that this person, to move their arms or their knees or their legs, the person, you know, complains of 10 out of 10 severe pain. When you see something and they have a rash on the skin, like a blanching maculopapular rash, when you see something like this, please, what should you be thinking about? Dengue, right? Think of dengue on your exams. Right? And many times, again, these people are going to have PTK and purpura on their skin. They may actually have bleeding, right? In fact, there's a reason why it's called dengue hemorrhagic fever, right? They can bleed, right? They can have a lot of plasma leakage. I'm going to discuss the pathophase here shortly, right? But they can have a lot of plasma leakage that leads them to have, you know, they can have like shock, you know, very severe bleeding, you know, multi-organ dysfunction syndrome and things like that, right? Now, one thing our friends at the MBMEs love to do is that they love to test a lot of integrations with dengue. So let's kind of talk through dengue, okay? So first things first, what's the bug that carries this? Well, I hope you're saying that, oh, divine, is the Aedes mosquito, right? The Aedes aegypti mosquito. The Aedes, A-E-D-E-S, aegypti is A-E-G-Y-P-T-I, the Aedes aegypti mosquito, right? And again, typically, in fact, like if you see a person that travels to a tropical area and they have like very high fevers, very severe headache, very nasty muscle pain, especially like retroorbital eye pain, PTKI purpura on the skin, ecchymosis on the skin, right? Think of a person having dengue hemorrhagic fever, right? Dengue is actually the most common arboviral disease worldwide. It's literally the most common arboviral disease worldwide. I think there's about 400 million infections that happen a year. All right. So what are some strange immunology-related things that our friends at the MBMEs want you to know about dengue? Again, dengue is heavily tested, guys. Dengue is heavily tested. Number one is that when you have a primary dengue infection, it's usually going to be a mild infection. It's usually going to be mostly asymptomatic. However, when you have a secondary infection with a different serotype, that infection can be life-threatening. It can literally lead to death. Okay? So again, let me break this down. the first infection you have, the primary infection, typically is not as bad as the secondary infection, right? Many times, if you get dengue the first time, you're going to have symptoms. It's going to suck, but it's not going to be as bad as if you have a different infection, a second infection, a secondary infection with a different serotype. When you see something like this, these people can have very severe symptoms and their mortality is much higher when they have a secondary infection with a different serotype, with a different serotype. So you may be asking, like, Divine, why is it that this, you know, because I've learned in immunology that the first time you encounter an infection, you know, you have like a very severe symptoms, but you know, down the line in the future, it's not as bad. Why do things seem to be different with dengue? Okay, let's break it down, right? And the thing is, the mechanism here is something called antibody-dependent enhancement. Antibody-dependent enhancement. Our friends at the MBMEs, they love to test this on the exams. And for whatever bizarre reason, many resources do not cover this, right? But the fact that many resources don't cover something does not mean that it's not very, very high yield to know for your test. Okay, so let's break this down. If you follow along with this, you're going to be able to keep this in mind, right? So again, what is this antibody-dependent enhancement? Well, the thing is, dengue has four serotypes. Right? Dengue literally has four serotypes. There's DENV1, right? DENV2, DENV3, and DENV4, right? So the thing is, when you have a primary infection, let's assume that, hey, the first infection you have is with DENV1, right? DENV1. The thing that will happen is when your body sees DENV1, your immune system is going to make anti-DENV1 antibodies, DENV1. Your immune system is going to make anti-DENV1 antibodies. These DENV1 antibodies, they're going to neutralize. They're going to absolutely just neutralize the DENV1. And you're going to feel good, right? You're going to feel good. But one thing people don't realize is that these anti-DENV1 antibodies, they have some mild cross-reactivity with DENV2, DENV3, and DENV4. So they cannot neutralize, they can only neutralize DENV1. They cannot neutralize DENV2, DENV3, and DENV4. They can cross-react with them, but they cannot neutralize them, right? So let's say, for example, you then get a second episode of dengue, but this second episode, you get it with DENV2 instead of DENV1. I can promise you that this second infection that they have is going to be much, 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 much worse than the first infection they had. In fact, they can die from this secondary infection, right? So what's the pathophase here? What's going on here? Remember what I said? I said anti-DENV1 antibodies neutralize DENV1, but they can cross-react. They cannot neutralize. They can only cross-react with DENV2, DENV3, and DENV4, right? So these anti-DENV1 antibodies, what do? If you have a secondary infection with DENV2, they will bind to DENV2. They will literally bind to DENV2, but they will not neutralize DENV2. The unfortunate thing that actually happens here is that they're actually going to coat the virus and facilitate the entry of the virus into your immune system cells. Whoa! They're going to coat the virus and then facilitate the ability of the virus to enter your immune system cells. Wow. Wow. Right? Wow. This is something you definitely need to understand for your exams, right? So what's the mechanism here? Well, the thing is, when these anti-DENV1 antibodies bind like DENV2, for example, right? Remember, every antibody has a constant region, right? When that constant region can be bound by a kind of receptor called the Fc gamma receptor. The Fc gamma receptor is a receptor that we find on many immune system cells, like your natural killer cells, your macrophages, right? Sometimes it's called CD16, right? So we find it on natural killer cells, we find it on monocytes, we find it on macrophages, we find it on dendritic cells, right? And this Fc gamma receptor can recognize the constant region of IgG. So if you have anti-DENV1 IgG antibodies that binds to DENV2, then the constant region of those anti-DENV1 antibodies will be bound by the Fc gamma receptor. And then when it's bound by the Fc gamma receptor, that actually facilitates, it almost provides like a highway for DENV2 to infect your white blood cells very, very effectively, to influence your white blood cells very, very efficiently, right? So when that happens, DEMF2 wreaks havoc on your white blood cells. It basically gains a lot of entry into many of your cells, and that causes you to get in very, very severe trouble. Because remember, whenever your white blood cells get infected, they start releasing all those nasty things that they have in their lumen. But what are those nasty things they release? Well, they release many of these acute phase reactants, you know, IL-1, IL-6, TNF-alpha. They can release things like interleukin-8. Right? And the thing is, these things cause a lot of inflammation. One of the things they do is that they increase vascular permeability, right? They increase vascular permeability. How? By disrupting your tight junctions, right? By disrupting your tight junctions, right? So if you increase vascular permeability by disrupting tight junctions, right, you're going to cause a lot of leakage of plasma from your blood vessels into tissue spaces, right? That's what's going to cause people to start having all this hemorrhage. Right, causing all this hemorrhage. And the thing is, because a lot of fluid is leaking from your bloodstream into your tissue spaces, the hemoglobin that is left behind in your bloodstream becomes very concentrated. So these people tend to be hemoconcentrated. So this is why, if we're giving you the dengue vaccine, we want to make sure that it covers DEMF1, DEMF2, DEMF3, and DEMF4. Okay, so please, on your exams, if they give you a question about a person that has a second dengue infection and they develop like very severe disease, very nasty septic shock, very nasty hemorrhage, and they ask you about the underlying mechanism, think about antibody-dependent. Think of antibody-dependent enhancement. Again, the pre-existing antibodies you made to the first infection, right? They made the second infection worse, not better. They literally made the second infection worse, not better. Okay, so again, remember, how do we diagnose dengue on the USMLE exams? Again, you can check the NS1 antigen, right? Or you can just check for antibodies, you can just do your antibody serologies, right? Against dengue, right? You can also do PCR, right? And again, the classic things you're going to see lab-wise, they're going to have low platelets, they're going to have thrombocytopenia, they're going to have leukopenia, their transaminases are going to be elevated, right? Their LFTs are going to be up, their AST, ALT is going to be up, right? And they're going to have a high hematocrit. Again, because of hemoconcentration, right? And how do we manage dengue? Supportive care, right? IV fluids, right? Normal saline, right? And please, right? What is one thing that gets people in trouble on the exams? They're like, oh, Divine, it is dengue hemorrhagic fever. So because they have fever, I can give them aspirin or NSAIDs. No, don't do that, right? Literally, look at the term that comes before the fever. Hemorrhagic, they are bleeding. Why do you want to give things that can cause them to bleed some more, like aspirin or an NSAID, right? That will not be a very smart idea in those people, right? That will not be a particularly smart idea in those people. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, traveled to some foreign country and the person has very, very high fevers, right? And the person has jaundice, right? And they give you, you know, the person is extremely hypotensive. And then you notice that they have this element of acute kidney injury, right? And you also notice that they are bradycardic. And they even tell you that, oh, they have like 3+ or 4+ proteinuria. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about yellow fever. And typically they will give it to a person that is traveling to, that has traveled to sub-Saharan Africa. In fact, let me tell you this. This is why, if you're traveling to sub-Saharan Africa, like Nigeria, for example, you know where I'm from, you have to have had a history of the yellow fever vaccine. That's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams, okay? If you're traveling to sub-Saharan Africa, like Nigeria, that is actually one vaccine that is required, right? Say, for example, you're an American, you're traveling to Nigeria, you better take that yellow fever vaccine because yellow fever can kill. Yellow fever can kill. If you have severe yellow fever infection, the mortality is about 50%. It's actually pretty nasty, right? Okay, so keep that at the back of your mind for your exam. So again, just to rehash, what are the key things you want to know about yellow fever for your exams? Again, how does it present? High fevers, right? Jaundice, right? And typically they'll have that jaundice with bradycardia, right? And it also causes acute kidney injury. It causes an AKI, right? So you may notice a lot of protein in the person's urine. And remember, this is carried by the Aedes mosquito as well, right? And again, don't forget the Sub-Saharan Africa Association or the South American Association, especially within the Amazon basin, right? And the thing is, sometimes if they want to make this question harder than it needs to be for you on your exams, instead of putting yellow fever as the answer on your exams, they can put flavivirus as the answer on your exams, right? So remember, yellow fever is a flavivirus infection. And the thing is, it has a very strong predilection for the liver. It loves the liver. It literally loves the liver. So when it gets to your liver, it infects your hepatocytes and causes necrosis of your hepatocytes. And when you cause necrosis of your hepatocytes, guess what, right? You're going to have albumin problems, right? You're going to have albumin problems. You're going to have clotting factor problems, right? That's why they can have hemorrhage. That's why they can bleed. That's why their LFTs go up, okay? So please keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? Keep that at the back of your mind for your exams, right? And how can we prevent this? Well, there's a live attenuated vaccine. There's a live attenuated vaccine. Again, this vaccine is required for entry to many countries, right? And the thing is, once you get the vaccine once, it's going to give you lifelong immunity. It's literally going to give you what? Lifelong immunity. Lifelong immunity. But again, remember, if you're a little kid, under age one, especially under age 6 months, no yellow fever vaccine for you. If you're pregnant, no yellow fever vaccine for you. If you're immunocompromised, no yellow fever vaccine for you, right? Or if you have like an egg allergy, no yellow fever vaccine for you as well, right? Pretty high yield to know that for your exams, right? Or if you have like DeGeorge syndrome, or you have like SCID, no yellow fever vaccine for you, right? Whenever you have like an absent thymus, the yellow fever vaccine is not a good idea, right? Because that's a correlate with nasty immunocompromise, okay? Nasty immunocompromise. All right. And generally, if a person is over age 60, you also want to be careful about giving them the yellow fever vaccine. Because remember, as you get older, your immunocompetence begins to wane quite a bit, begins to wane quite a bit. All right. Man, this podcast has gone on for longer than I planned. You know what? Let's maybe go ahead and pause here. I will do another travel medicine. Again, like I said, it's going to be a two or three part series. Again, the thing is, for my podcast, I know people say like, oh, Devon, you then go off in this direction and then in this direction. The thing is, those integrations will help you on your exams. The USMLEs, they don't, that's the thing. Like, this is probably one of the most common complaints I've heard with my podcast. Devon, your podcasts are not linear. You keep going in different dimensions. The reason I do that is because that's literally a much better way to prep for your exams. It's uncomfortable, but it's a better way to prep for your tests, right? My goal here is not to make you comfortable, because if I make you comfortable, but I'm not prepping you well for your exams, then what was the benefit of spending 45 minutes or thereabouts listening to me, right? It's better to deal with discomfort, but it helps you prep well, right? Growth happens in the midst of discomfort, right? You've probably heard this term. I guess think of this as a life lesson, that necessity is the mother of invention, right? So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind as you go through your life. All right. So if you love the way I teach, and again, God willing, you know, we're going to have another episode, episode 632 is going to be travel medicine part two. But if you love the way I teach, you love the way I make integrations, you're going to love my classes. Many people have taken my classes and done extremely well on their exams, right? In this month of February, starting next week, Monday, I do have a series of classes for step one all the way to step three. So what are my step one all the way to step three classes? Well, I have my test taking strategies class. It's 2.5 hours long. I have my biostatistics class. It's 4 hours long. I have my social sciences and ethics and quality improvement and hospital medicine class. That's 5 hours long. Those classes are for step one all the way to step three. But for step two and step three specifically, I have a last minute review that is 3 hours long. I have a 20-hour step two, step three review that is, 20 hours long. And then I have a class that is held only once a year. It's in the month of June. It's a 50-hour, 500 multiple choice question step two, step three class. I mean, that class is phenomenal. People that have taken the class have done just extremely well on their exams, right? So if you're interested in any of these classes, I'm the one that teaches all of these classes in their entirety. There's not like some TA that's teaching those classes. No, it's literally me over Zoom that teaches the whole class. If you're interested, shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify, and also offer one-on-one tutoring. I also help with applications, right? Like ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, rec letters, and things like that, right? And then I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Every week, many of you know I'm a Christ follower. I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. And then don't forget that I have a YouTube channel where I also post the videos that I make. So thank you for listening to me in today's episode. Again, I know it was kind of a lot, but again, there's so many exam questions you're going to get right from this stuff that are not even related to travel medicine. So thank you for listening to me. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in episode 632. Bye for now.